We Jews, as you know, talk an awful lot about learning Torah. But it is amazing sometimes how much you can learn about the Torah by actually reading it. And I want to read you a passage this morning that you may not be familiar with from this morning's Parsha. That when I read it early this week, I thought this is phenomenal, remarkable, astonishing that this passage is in there. And I began to explore some of the commentaries on it. And I realized that it was important that people hear it and what I think is the underlying message, which in some ways is the opposite of the message that we get when we first read it. I hope all this will become clear in a second. So Israel's about to go to war. And the first thing that happens is the priest calls everyone together and says, Shema Yisrael, listen Israel, God will be with us and we will be successful and we should be good and devotional and all that. Just what you would expect. Then the priest is done with his part. And the officials, the army officials, the city officials, come in front of the army. And this is what they are supposed to say, according to Shoftim. When the officials address the troops, now they're talking about the troops, they're already ready. They say as follows, is there anyone who has built a new house but hasn't dedicated it? Let him go back to his home, lest he die in battle and another dedicate it. Is there anyone who's planted a vineyard but hasn't harvested it? If so, let him go back to his home, lest he die in battle and another harvest it. Is there anyone who has been betrothed but has not yet gotten married? If so, let him go back to his home, lest he die in battle and someone else marry her. The officials shall go on addressing the troops and say, is there anybody who is afraid and disheartened? Let him go home, lest his fear spread among the troops. Now, first of all, I think it's important to note that no other army that I'm aware of has ever formulated rules like this. And you can imagine why. I can just, you know, I imagine in ancient Israel, if people knew a war was coming, all of a sudden they would say, sweetheart, let's get engaged. She would say, oh, you want to marry me? You'd say, no, I just want to be engaged. Because if you're engaged, you don't have to go. If you're already married, then you go to war. And in fact, this is not only my fantasy of what must have happened then. You know, each year on Purim, you are allowed to make fun of your teachers, of the Torah. It's the one day of the year when Jews can make mockery of everything that's sacred. And in the great Volozhin Yeshiva, which was the greatest bastion of learning of Torah in Eastern Europe, apparently one year they had a Purim play based on this passage. And they had 100,000 people, it wasn't really 100,000, but that's how many they represented, ready to go to war. And then they went through all the instructions and gradually they all left and they left and they left and they said, is anyone afraid? And they were left with four people at the end to go to battle. And you can imagine that this would happen, so you have to ask yourself, why in the world would the Torah formulate these laws? You'll notice that all the laws, except for the last one, we can understand someone who's terrified is going to be bad for morale. But all the others about if you're betrothed but not married, if you've planted a vineyard but have not harvested it, if you have built a home but have not yet lived in it, all of those are about realizing the potential of what you have done. You, having put in this effort, should realize its result. Because war, after all, promises no one that they will come home, and therefore you should taste something of life's sweetness before you are imperiled. And that is, in fact, how almost all the commentators speak about it. They notice that later on in Deuteronomy, that's the curse that's given. The curse in chapter 28 reads, If you pay the bride price for a wife, another man will enjoy her. If you build a house, you shall not live in it. If you plant a vineyard, you shall not harvest it. In other words, the worst thing is to work for something and never see its fruit. And therefore, Israel will not do that to its own people. And it promises, even a soldier, even in a time of war, when it is most crucial that everyone mobilize, that they first have some taste of what life is before they imperil it. So my first reaction in reading and thinking about this was that here is a time, a beautiful example, a wonderful instance, when Israel as a collective, as a people, who need their soldiers, who have to fight, gives way to the individual. To say the desires and the needs and the potential and the realization of that single soul takes precedence over the needs of the community. And even though we need you on the front, it's more important that you go home and marry your wife. Even though the war is going to be difficult, we don't want you to constantly be thinking about the house that you never got to live in. But then I began examining the commentators. And although some of them give this interpretation, some of them turn it on its head. And they say, you might think that this is for the individual, but really, it's for the people. First of all, you don't want a soldier there who can't think about fighting. And people who are constantly thinking of the home front are dangerous to have in troops where you need mobilization and single-mindedness. But more than that, it's very dangerous for a community to take all the men, especially all the young men, and put them on the front. In fact, this is exactly what happens later on in the book of Samuel. When David goes off to fight the Philistines and he brings all the young men of the town with him, while they're all gone, the Amalekites come in the back of the town and burn the town. And so, say some commentators, you know that you have to have a certain percentage of men stay behind, and these rules enable certain men to stay behind. They are not exempt from service in the city, they just don't have to go to the front lines. And then, the other comment is, the reason this is good for the collective is because the army officers say it. And what are you saying to your troops when you say, okay, this percentage of people can go home? You're saying, we have absolute confidence that we will win this war, so much so that we don't even need every single person whom we could mobilize to win it. And that by allowing some people to go home, it increases the spirit and the confidence of the rest of the army. Now, why do I bring this up apart from the intrinsic fascination of this passage? Because what the commentators have done is taken something designed for the individual and made it about the community. And I started to think of modern analogies. What happens when you marry someone? You don't do it, just the two of you privately. You go to weddings, and all of a sudden, what should be a very intimate moment between two people is surrounded by hundreds of people. And they're all watching you as you make that first declaration of love, as you kiss. You know, not only are they watching you, but these days the videographer is watching you, and the flash photographer is watching you, and the recorder is watching you. Why is that? Because betrothal and marriage, that which is most intimate, is also communal. What do you do when you harvest a field? In our tradition, if you have a success in business, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to take a percentage of that success, turn right around, and give it to tzedakah. Why? Because it's not only about you. Because the blessing that you're given, whether the blessing of love or the blessing of prosperity is not only yours, it's the community's. And the same thing is true with a house. Why do you invite people over when you dedicate a house? Why do you put a mezuzah on the outside of the house? Because your house is not only for you, it's for everyone. In other words, just as here, where you think that this is an individual rule, but it's really a communal rule, so Judaism takes the most intimate, individual moments of our lives and teaches a central lesson, which is that there is nothing in the world that's only about you. That what you do, what you believe, how you act invariably has ripples on the community around you. Whether you decide to go home or you decide to fight, it won't only affect you, it affects everyone. Your marriage doesn't only affect you. And by the way, let me just say something about marriage, just parenthetically. This is when most people learn how much what they do affects everyone. If you have had the privilege of sitting, as I have, with many, many, many couples as they get married, they're astonished the extent to which the guest list is a cause of controversy. Right? Who knew? I mean, part of being getting married is offending someone, right? That should be the definition. Getting married means to offend somebody in your family. Because the seating and the guest list and the honors, and I mean, it can go on and on. Now, why is that? Because at a certain point, the bride or the groom almost always turns to me and says, I don't understand, I'm marrying her. What's that got to do with her uncle's cousin from Florida, whom she hasn't seen in 20 years and all of a sudden is upset because he's sitting with her uncle's other cousin from San Diego, who she saw last week? And the answer is, there is nothing that is completely individual. Nothing. Not falling in love, not getting married, not making money, not building a house, not raising a child. It's all about all of us. And there is a matter of degree, of course. Some things are more public, some things are more private. But there's nothing that's only about you. And that brings us to this time of year. We come together to do tshuva. Why? It's between you and God, but it's not only between you and God. What you've done and what you will do, it will touch everyone around you. What you leave undone will touch everyone around you. Ashamnu, we say, bagadnu. We have sinned because it is our collective responsibility to be better. And what devolves on all of us devolves on each of us. That is, if it's all of our responsibilities, it's also my responsibility. Yes, some of us will go to war and some of us will build a house. But we are tied each to each. And nobody is allowed to opt out. Al tifrosh min hatzibur, says Hillel. Which I have always translated along with everybody else as don't separate yourself from the community. But maybe Hillel was also implying that you can't, even if you try. Because in your separation, you are affecting the community. If you're not here, that has an effect on us too. You remember that powerful passage in Dickens' Christmas Carol, where they come to Scrooge and they say, what will you give to the community? And he says, nothing. And they say, will you give this? Will you give that? And he says, all I wish to do is to be left alone. I only want to be left alone. But of course, the whole story is about how it's not possible for someone to be left alone. We're all touched by the past, the present, the future, and by the circle of our influence, by those around us who care for what we do, who care for what we don't. So as we approach Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, as we consider what it is that we want for our country, for the land of Israel, for our families, for our souls, let's remember the lesson of that remarkable passage. Before each of us, that officer stands and says, "You may not be able to fulfill this responsibility, we understand that, but then you have to fulfill that one. You may not be able to do this, but you can do that." Every one of us has a job, a task, a responsibility, a mission, a calling, and a destiny. We are bound, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, by two covenants, the covenant of history and the covenant of destiny. We share a past, and together, all of us create a future. May we together, in the coming year, create a future of goodness, a future of kindness, a future of giving, and a future of peace. Amen.